From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. That now infamous tweet that Roseanne Barr sent out yesterday cost her job. ABC canceled her show after Roseanne tweeted about President Obama's former aide, Valerie Jarrett. She wrote, "Muslim Brotherhood and Planet of the Apes had a baby equals VJ." Roseanne has apologized, but she was tweeting in response to another tweet from a website called SGT Report, which bills itself as the corporate propaganda antidote. The top story on that site today is about Pizzagate, the debunked conspiracy theory that Democrats were using a DC pizza restaurant for child trafficking. Roseanne Barr is no stranger to conspiracy theories, which are gaining influence in the age of Trump. Joining us now is Jane Costin, senior political reporter for Vox. Jane, welcome.
Hello, how are you doing?
Doing well. And let's start with this site, SGT Report that Roseanne was retweeting. I've never heard of it.
Well, I don't think most people have. I think it's important to be clear that this particular corner of the right-wing internet is not very big, but it's very deep. And there are these outlets, which I think Roseanne has a lot of experience with, that are basically just pushing forward conspiracy theories, among them Pizzagate or QAnon, which is a conspiracy theory that argues that Robert Mueller and Trump are working together to arrest Democrats, and there will be 20,000 people sent to prison, including Hillary Clinton. And that's just the very start of it. But this is a space she knows extremely well. She's appeared on conspiracy-minded podcasts for another site. In 2017, she appeared on one saying that the reason why Hollywood wasn't behind Trump is because they're being controlled by the CIA through MKUltra, which is a real CIA experiment conducted in the 1960s. And so this is a space Roseanne had a lot of experience with and has for a very long time.
And when it comes to Valerie Jarrett, and she was the target of that Roseanne tweet. Now, a lot of attention has been paid to the Planet of the Apes part, people calling that racist. The other part of that tweet is the Muslim Brotherhood part. Now, there is a theory out there. It's a hoax that Valerie Jarrett, in her 1977 Stanford yearbook, had a quote in there that she said, "I'm a Muslim and I want to make the U.S. More of a Muslim nation." That is a fake yearbook photo that's been floating around on the internet for some time.
Right. Well, especially because Valerie Jarrett's parents, James E. Bowman and Barbara Taylor Bowman, were both American-born African-American citizens from Washington, D.C. and Chicago, respectively. They were living in Iran at the time while her father served as chair of pathology at a children's hospital in Shiraz, Iran. This is before the fall of the Shah in the late 1970s in Iran. So this would be under, you know, under a very different regime. And, you know, first and foremost, Valerie Jarrett was not Valerie Jarrett at the time. She would have been Valerie Bowman as she got married in 1983. But this is something I think that there really is, and this is very easy, you know, to push online through memes or through these images that go viral, is that, you know, this is very clearly a fake yearbook photo. People do not say things like, "I am an Iranian by birth and of my Islamic faith." That doesn't make any sense, you know, from coming from a fluent English speaker or like an American citizen. It confirms what people want to believe, which is that this person who was very close and is very close to former President Barack Obama is some sort of suspicious Muslim interloper. I think that, you know, it's interesting because Roseanne has also tweeted incredibly offensive insults about Huma Abedin, who is, you know, very close with former Secretary of State and former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. And so I think that there very much is, especially within the more conspiratorial sides of the far right, there very much is this idea that Barack Obama, not only was he Muslim, but he was just surrounded by, you know, evil Muslim interlopers.
Now, Roseanne is not alone in believing some of these conspiracy theories. You call it a small corner of the internet. You could say that President Trump has encouraged some of these conspiracy theories, especially when it comes to the deep state, which he talks about all the time. How many people believe these things, and how much does mainstream news in some places encourage it?
Well, I think to answer your first question, I would say the number of people who believe in this is not particularly big, but the people who do believe it a lot. And so, you know, we're not talking millions and millions of people, but we are talking about the people who do, who are very active online and very active in wanting to talk about these conspiracy theories and discuss them and kind of reprove them to themselves. And to your second question, I think that one challenge that mainstream news has is I think that there's very much, you know, after the end of the Fairness Doctrine in the 1980s, but also the sense that, like, well, you know, both sides have a good point. And this idea that you need to present people with, well, this is what some people say, I think that that, in a way, can encourage this, because I think that there's an urge to want to focus on the conspiracy theories, an urge to want to just, you know, focus on it and then disprove it, or, you know, try to explain why people believe it, which actually doesn't help disprove it, but it does help to spread it.
That's Jane Costin, who is a senior political reporter for Vox. Jane, thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
Let's scan the energy horizon. Natural gas is said to be the cleaner future. It's replaced coal as the country's top power source, but it's also causing problems for nuclear power. And as Reed Frazier of the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania reports, that can mean a setback in the efforts to curb climate change.
It was just 4 years ago when President Obama said this about natural gas.
If extracted safely, it's the bridge fuel that can power our economy with less of the carbon pollution that causes climate change.
Obama's prediction was partially right. Hundreds of coal plants have closed. But now something else is happening, too. The Three Mile Island nuclear plant near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, creates enough electricity to power 800,000 homes. But the plant is slated to shut down next year. Inside a control room, shift manager Nick Favorito says he hopes that doesn't happen.
We're hopeful that we'll work with the PA legislature to find a solution to keep these plants running, since they are carbon-free source electricity, a large carbon-free source electricity. We want to see them keep going because we have so many good people here.
But that could be tough for the plant's owner, Exelon. The plant can't make money in an electricity market flooded by cheap natural gas. Nuclear energy is about twice as expensive to make as the same amount of electricity from natural gas, according to the federal government. MIT researcher Jesse Jenkins says that's a bad thing for the climate.
So if your concern is about climate change and you view it as an urgent and perhaps even existential threat to human society and to the environment, then you should be very concerned about the closure of nuclear power plants. And indeed, it's the thing that keeps me up most at night right now.
Jenkins studies ways to lower the carbon footprint of the electric grid. He says nuclear plants around the country are retiring much sooner than they have to. First Energy also announced it was closing three of its nuclear plants in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Jenkins says each of these are large sources of carbon-free electricity that'll probably be replaced by natural gas, which emits CO2, though not as much as coal.
Losing each one is a significant step back at a time we should be making rapid progress towards a zero-carbon energy system.
An industry-funded study found the four nuclear plants scheduled to close in Ohio and Pennsylvania provide more emissions-free electricity than all the wind and solar in the entire Mid-Atlantic grid, a region that serves 65 million people. To stay in business, nuclear plant owners are turning to states and the federal government for help. First Energy has asked the federal government to declare a grid emergency to keep its endangered coal and nuclear plants running. New York and Illinois are subsidizing struggling nuclear plants by giving them zero emissions credits. These are basically subsidies states pay to nuclear plants for the carbon pollution these plants are preventing. Matt Wald is with the Nuclear Energy Institute, an industry trade group. He says the credits are necessary.
Sun or no sun, we are seeking to have the market recognize the things that we provide to the system. It doesn't do that now.
Nuclear's precarious situation is a complicated one for environmental groups who have long opposed nuclear energy. Tom Schuster is with the Sierra Club in Pennsylvania. He worries about nuclear's environmental problems, like radioactive waste, impacts from uranium mining, and the risk of a Fukushima-type disaster. But then again, he doesn't want natural gas to become nuclear's replacement.
And if they're replaced by plants that burn fracked gas, then that's definitely a problem.
Nuclear remains the country's top source of carbon-free electricity. So the Sierra Club supported a nuclear bailout in Illinois that also promoted renewables.
I kind of think about it as thinking about nuclear plant policy as a phase out rather than a bailout.
The best way to get this to happen, he says, is through a tax on carbon emissions. That would make coal and natural gas more expensive to produce and help carbon-free energy, including nuclear, wind, and solar. But that's not likely to happen at the federal level right now, so the industry has been asking for help from states. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy just signed a $300 million bailout for his state's nuclear plants. But it's not an easy sell in other places. In Pennsylvania, the state's large natural gas industry opposes any bailout for nuclear, and there are no bills in the legislature that would do so right now. For Here and Now, I'm Reed Frazier.
The Americans ends tonight. The FX show about the husband and wife Russian spy team Philip and Elizabeth Jennings, played by real-life couple Matthew Reese and Kerry Russell, who pose as Americans living in a D.C. suburb with their children, running a travel agency while murderously carrying out espionage in Cold War Washington. In this scene, Philip wears a black cap pulled down low. Elizabeth's long hair is tucked under a short wig during an interrogation.
It's going to be okay, Liz. All you have to do is answer some quick, easy questions, and then we'll let you go. Nothing bad will happen. You understand? It is really important that you nod so that we know you understand.
The show was created by ex-CIA officer Joe Weisberg after several Russian spies were discovered living in America. How true to form is it? Well, Jonna Mendez is 27-year career CIA. She was head of disguise. Ben Affleck played her agent husband Tony Mendez in the film Argo. And Jonna, you say the killings and the sex are over the top, but you recently wrote you love the Americans. Now, Philip's thick glasses and mustache, they often look like a Groucho mask. Elizabeth has a million wigs, always the same face. But you say the Americans got it right.
I think they did. The way they do dead drops, the way surveillance works to either follow someone or to be followed. The seduction scenes are a little beyond and above and all of that. But the poisons, that goes back to CIA's old MK Ultra program where we had, what did we have? Cobra venom. Of course, we got rid of it.
To poison other people or to take it if you were caught?
Well, there was always that. There's something called an L pill, which is cyanide. And it was very carefully controlled. And it was controlled out of my office and very seldom given out. Not to kill someone. But if someone working for us would say, I will work for you, but if they catch me, I'd rather be able to take my own life than have them do to me what they're going to do to me, we would give it to them.
And to be clear, poisoning others is not allowed.
Oh, that was never, right. that was never in the mix.
Yeah.
In terms of disguise, I was kind of impressed with what they were able to do with him. He wore his disguises really well. They were very believable, I thought, on him. Just changing the hairstyle, and never mind that mustache. The mustaches are always hard. But he would put on a skull cap and a pair of glasses and have a fake ponytail out the back. Or he changed, though, more than his facial oval. His demeanor changed.
Actually, you write that it was harder for the men to even want to wear the disguises than for women to do it.
Well, men don't want to wear the disguises. Men think you should be able to just kind of muscle your way through situations and you shouldn't have to hide behind a wig. That point of view changed over the years as the targets that CIA was looking at, they also changed. We went from embassy cocktail parties to working with terrorists, working against drugs. And the people we were working against were much, much more physically threatening. Some of our officers discovered that a good disguise can be like a suit of armor.
And we understand that there are CIA officers who have something called notional cover. It's a thin guise. They might have a phony company they've set up. Official cover, which is when they actually are working in another government agency.
Well, notional cover is some throwaway kind of cover that you might be talking to someone on an airplane and they'd say, oh, you're out of Washington. Where do you work? Say, I work for the government. Very light cover. official cover is when you have documentation and maybe a phone number that backs it up.
And so there are CIA spies who are placed in different departments around the world who have jobs there and then go do their work. Non-official cover, NOC, what's that?
Non-official cover is an officer who is completely detached from the U.S. government presence wherever they are because they are part of a private business. They are part of a private enterprise.
Or they might be scientists somewhere or researchers.
There are some things that it cannot be. The cover cannot be the media. Can't use the priesthood for cover. Peace Corps. People in those professions are vulnerable to being accused of working for the CIA. None of our people will ever use those categories.
When any of these people need disguises, is it true that, like Elizabeth and Philip, they might keep them behind the circuit board in the garage or behind the washer-dryer, wigs and things?
Most people keep them in an office kind of environment. You just want them where they're at hand if you need them.
What were some of the disguises you might use or have another agent use?
Well, you might take a person who has a kind of military appearance. Think of the look of a U.S. Marine. That high and tight buzz cut. They're all kind of over-muscled, ramrod straight. So some of the things you'd want to do is change his posture. You'd want to get his shoulders to come down and get him to a more relaxed and normal posture. And you can do that with shoulder braces. You put them on backwards. Instead of pulling you up straight, they kind of tug you down.
Huh.
Make him more messy. Make him more casual. Make him just demilitarize him.
What's the most interesting disguise that you've worn?
It would probably be a disguise I wore to the White House to meet the president. This was the first President Bush. He had been the director of CIA, and we had issued him a disguise while he was working at CIA. And so when we came up with this kind of new category of disguise, our senior people thought the president might enjoy seeing it.
What was it?
It was a full face mask with hair that completely changed the way I looked. And I wore it into the White House. I wore it into the Oval Office. And I briefed the president for a few minutes and then took it off.
Wow. Talk about the fact that Philip and Elizabeth live such a lie. Your husband had to have the talk with his children from another marriage to tell them what he did because they got suspicious. We watched this happen in The Americans where the kids are like, what's going on? As a viewer, you're starting to think, who's raising these kids? Because the two parents are always gone. Are they away that much?
When we're watching The Americans, remember that they're away from their home base. When you're talking about CIA officers, it's when we are overseas. Overseas, Tony and I, we were working in the part of CIA that's like, it's like the Q in James Bond. It's a little bit Mission Impossible. We did a lot of things besides disguise.
So what did you tell people? And what did he tell his kids before he told them the truth?
The kids, they wouldn't ask, but you would just see that they noticed it. The kids weren't the problem as much overseas as the neighbors. You know, and a lot of times it was American neighbors who were working for various U.S. government offices. And they'd say, well, we're all in a military situation here, but you guys have different furniture and you have different washer dryers and you drive different cars. And what's going on there? Mm-hmm. It was the Stan, what's his name, Beeman? It was the FBI guy next door.
What are the chances of that?
That was amazing. The writers of this show must have had so much fun.
Well, he starts to suspect. This is the neighbor who, yes, works for the FBI. He starts to suspect there's something wrong with the way his neighbors are traveling so much.
Yes.
And he starts to look things up. I don't want to, you know, not everybody is up to speed, so I don't want to give things away. But you can find things out. And we've been reading that, for instance, when people have that notional cover, sometimes it can be a fake company that you tell people, you have cards for it. And maybe there's somebody sitting back answering a phone for that fake company. But if somebody looks a little bit further, they'll find that that company isn't real. What did you tell people?
If you got in a situation where you kind of had to respond, if it was notional cover, light cover, I would always say, who are you and where do you work? Because if I'm going to say I'm a heart surgeon, I don't want him to be, you know, an intern at GW Hospital saying, oh, what floor are you working on? Now, if you have real cover, it's okay. You hand them the card because, you know, if they make the phone call, there's somebody answering and they will take messages for you and, you know, you're out of the office, can they call you back? My husband, there was a movie made about him. The movie was Argo, and a whole big part of that movie was about the cover for rescuing a group of people out of Tehran. And it was just elaborately put together. No matter how they checked on that cover, it was going to hold up. It was a life or death situation.
Jana, what was it like to live a lie? And related to the Americans, too, because it seems to be taking a toll on Philip and Elizabeth. He's decided he doesn't want to be in the spy world anymore. She's deep into it, but starting to feel some thoughts about her work. But
yeah,
they're both recognizing that they are each good liars.
My husband and I, we never really had to lie to each other, but there were many, many things that we couldn't tell each other. You kept it in within the guardrails that had been set up for that case. My best friend for many, many years didn't know where I worked. She was my best friend. We'd talk endlessly on the phone, just like you would with your best friend. Mm. And I always had to live this lie. She found out about 20 years into our friendship, and she couldn't believe that I worked for the CIA all that time and didn't tell her. In a way, it cost me that friendship.
Yeah.
All of our neighbors where we lived for all of those years, nobody knew where we worked. When Tony's involvement with CIA was revealed, they were almost angry.
Well, let me ask you this. You've been very complimentary of the creator, Joe Weisberg, the former CIA
yes.
officer.
Yes.
But have you found yourself somebody who might have worked on the other side of a Philip and an Elizabeth? Have you found it odd that you maybe have grown to like them?
Oh, I think that was very much their purpose. And I think that's part of what made this show so great. They showed you the politics and then they took you beyond the politics where you're looking at two people in a marriage trying to balance work and life. It's inside of every household in America.
Jana, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. It was lovely talking to you.
And again, Jana Mendez, former chief of disguise for the CIA. The Americans ends tonight. Do not call me. Let us know if you'll be watching. HereNow.org.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Organic, all-natural, cage-free, non-GMO, all those certifications are there to tell you about the product you're buying and its impact on the environment. Now an eco-label in the Pacific Northwest is Salmon Safe, which is a good thing for salmon. And the label's founders are trying to take it mainstream. Eilish O'Neill from KUOW reports.
Yeah, chick, 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 chick.
That's 80-year-old Jim Wilcox calling to hundreds of his chickens. They're all crowded around a little house where they can get water and shelter from the bald eagles circling overhead. The Wilcoxes have egg farms in Oregon, Montana, and here, in the shadow of Mount Rainier in Washington State. Wilcox's chicken calls do the trick. First one bird, then another, and finally the whole flock lurches toward us. Wilcox says over the past 20 years, his customers both at small upscale grocery stores and at big chains like Costco have started asking a lot of questions.
Were we good stewards of the land? Since we have so many waterways that we either border or run through our property, were we taking good care of those?
Wilcox Farms borders the Nisqually River, which has runs of steelhead and salmon. And farming can be hard on fish. Think pesticides, irrigation draining creeks, and...
With all these chickens, we have tons and tons of fertilizer.
The salmon and steelhead in the Nisqually River have been declining for decades, and that's a huge concern for the Nisqually tribe.
When the first fish comes back, you thank that salmon for coming home and sustaining your life.
That's a recording of Billy Frank Jr. before his death in 2014. Frank was a member of the Nisqually tribe and a legendary activist for tribal fishing rights.
We can't band-aid this watershed. We've got to think about it for all of us, for everyone, to have clean water, quality and quantity of that water, to have salmon, to have them trees, to have all that medicine.
The way Jim Wilcox tells it, Billy Frank Jr. is a big reason he decided to change the way he runs his farm. It was Billy Frank who encouraged Wilcox to stop using pesticides, to plant trees by waterways, and to keep chicken manure out of the water. That would earn him a salmon-safe label for his eggs. Wilcox says he decided
that's where our future lay.
The salmon-safe label was created in the late 90s by the Pacific Rivers Council. The environmental group's goal was to let consumers know which farmers did right by fish, and to get people to pay more for those products, the same way they would pay more for organic produce.
We started out working with vineyards in the Willamette Valley.
Dan Kent's the executive director of Salmon Safe. He says today, more than 800 farms from Alaska to Northern California have the certification, including a full third of Oregon's vineyards.
What we've learned is that the real value we can deliver to certified landowners is market access.
In other words, given the choice, certain supermarkets lean towards Salmon Safe options. Kent says his next goal is to start working with more wheat, apple, and dairy farmers. Back on the Wilcox farm, I climb into Jim's old Jeep.
It's kind of an old beater.
You know, I can take it on the old back roads.
We bump over a rutted dirt road to the Nisqually River, and Wilcox shows me where he and his sons and nephew are planning to pull out a dike and let the river flood about 15 acres of their land.
The river's going to be allowed to just kind of meander in here, and hopefully it'll just create a still water where little fingerlings, feeder-type fish can thrive.
With any luck, Wilcox says, he hopes the Nisqually steelhead will come back. For Here and Now, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Pierce County, Washington.
Missouri Governor Eric Greitens got some good news today. A St. Louis prosecutor is dropping one of the criminal charges against him, the one alleging he had improperly given a charity donor list to his political campaign. The Republican governor resigned yesterday after months of mounting scandals, criminal charges, and the prospect of impeachment.
The last few months have been incredibly difficult for me, for my family, for my team, for my friends, and for many, many people that I love. This ordeal has been designed to cause an incredible amount of strain on my family.
Greitens had been indicted on a felony charge of invasion of privacy for taking an explicit photo of a woman he was having an affair with without her permission and threatening to share it. That charge was dropped earlier this month. Joining us now is Brian Ellison, who covers Missouri politics for KCUR in Kansas City. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Greitens had denied the allegations against him and had refused to step down until now. What changed?
Yeah, this was what was so surprising to a lot of people. Obviously, a former Navy SEAL, not a quitter, and had made a commitment to fight this to the end. But a lot of people are pointing to something that happened yesterday morning. A judge in Cole County, that's where Jefferson City is, ruled that a subpoena from the House Investigating Committee, this is the group that was considering impeachment charges, a subpoena of Greitens' campaign and of a 501c4, one of those so-called dark money organizations that has been supporting the governor's agenda, had perhaps shared information. That's the suggestion that's been made, which would be illegal. They subpoenaed records of both of those, the campaign and the organization, and a judge ruled that subpoena could be enforced and the documents needed to be turned over. A few hours later, the governor resigned. Is that the only reason? We don't know, but it certainly was an interesting appearance of maybe that being the final straw.
But back up a second here. This had nothing to do with the explicit photograph.
Well, right. So in some ways, a lot of legislators who were pursuing the possible impeachment of the governor seem to have moved on from some of those allegations. The criminal case, the invasion of privacy charge, had been withdrawn by the prosecutor in St. Louis. It was referred to a special prosecutor over here on the Kansas City side who was considering refiling the charges. And that prosecutor, Jean Peters Baker, says she still is considering that. However, the investigation had now stretched well beyond all of that into the charity donations and into the conduct of and the handling of money in the governor's campaign.
And the impeachment proceedings were ongoing, even though the House in Missouri is overwhelmingly Republican.
Yes, super majorities, more than two-thirds Republican in both the House and the Senate. And that's one of the really interesting parts of this story, Jeremy, is that although the governor in ads running on television has portrayed this as a Democratic attack funded by liberals from out of state, in fact, almost all of the criticism of the governor has come from Republicans in Missouri.
What does this mean for the election coming up later this year? There is a very important Senate race in Missouri. Claire McCaskill, the Democratic senator, is going to face a Republican. It could be Josh Hawley, who's the attorney general, who actually released a statement right after Greitens resigned. He said that Governor Greitens has done the right thing today. If he does face McCaskill, is he going to be hurt by this situation?
Well, that's an interesting political question right now, is whether the resignation of Greitens helps Hawley or hurts him. One thinks it probably helps him. Josh Hawley had been drawn into this debate because his office of attorney general was part of the investigations. A lot of Democrats challenged Hawley for not investigating sooner or more thoroughly the suggestions that the governor was mishandling funds or that his campaign was, rather. On the other hand, this does change the narrative, and the fact that the governor has now resigned, saying he was wrong, might make him even more the face of this Republican Party and of Hawley's campaign. There are already ads running that show Josh Hawley and Eric Greitens' faces together, and I am certain that Claire McCaskill, who is a very savvy campaigner, will do everything she can to link the two.
Why did Greitens hang on for so long amid all of this? There's been some analysis that he's kind of playing with the Trump model of just not admitting that anything had gone wrong and holding out.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have drawn that comparison. There are some key differences. Certainly in Missouri, a really key difference is that the Republican Party, at least those with the levers of power in the legislature, were not standing with Eric Greitens the way that I think we've seen in Congress. I think a lot of us did expect Greitens to fight this to the end. A lot of journalists were surprised by yesterday's announcement. Certainly, if he had been true to his own word, he would have continued fighting this and continuing to sound those themes that this was a political witch hunt out to get him.
Tell us about the person who's going to take over for Governor Greitens, Lieutenant Governor Michael Parson. He'll take over on Friday.
That's right. Mike Parson is everything as a Republican politician in Missouri that Eric Greitens was not. He is not an outsider. He was the Polk County Sheriff for 13 years, I believe. He was in the House. He was in the Senate. He is respected across the party. He's kind of the handshaking, backslapping politician that Missouri is accustomed to. He also has the respect of Democrats, not so much for his policies. He's actually very conservative and in many ways wouldn't have a huge amount of policy differences with Eric Greitens. But he is seen as civil. He is seen as reasonable. That's the word of House Democratic Leader Gail McCann Beatty yesterday. She said she looks forward to working with him. Senator Claire McCaskill, U.S. Senator, said the same thing. I think there is a lot of hope that a certain level of normalcy can return to Missouri politics, and Mike Parson will be a part of that.
That's Brian Ellison, who covers Missouri politics at KCUR in Kansas City. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Tropical Depression Alberto is still dumping rains on part of the country, and in the western mountains of North Carolina, there was fear about a dam that was about to fail. Officials have lifted the evacuation orders, deeming the dam safe. Matt Bush is news director at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina. He joins us now. Matt, so the dam is safe, but flooding is still a big concern.
Yes, right now we're seeing some flooding in the immediate areas around Asheville and actually all throughout western North Carolina, but some of the newest flooding is the flooding that's happening in Asheville in the Biltmore Village area just to the south of the city.
And what about mudslides? That's also a concern.
Lots of mudslides. We've had mudslides really all month. The problem here right now in western North Carolina is there have been areas that have received 2 feet of rain in 2 weeks. So the mudslide started last weekend. There was a woman killed in her home by a mudslide in Polk County, which is to the south of Asheville. And there have been mudslides. There was some slides that closed Interstate 40 in both directions last night near in McDowell County, near where this dam at Lake Tahoma, where officials were fearing that it was going to fail overnight.
Are there fears that if there's more rain, that the dam could be a problem again?
We'll see on that. There was a landslide that hit the dam, and that's basically what triggered this sort of warning. But they were quick to point out that there were no breaks in the dam and that no water actually had been coming over it out of what's normal. So an abundance of caution, I think, really happened because we've had some incidents here in the past 2 weeks. We had something happen on Monday where two television journalists were killed by a tree that fell in this area. And it was believed that tree fell because of all the rain that has been falling in the area. It loosened the roots around the tree and fell. So I think everybody here is using a lot of caution right now just with anything regarding this rain because we still have rain forecast for the rest of the week here.
This is an area with a lot of transplants. A lot of people retire in western North Carolina. There are a lot of tourists there. How is that going? Can people get around right now if they need to?
Well, in the Biltmore Village area, that is near where the Biltmore Estate is, one of the largest, probably the largest tourist attraction in the area. So right now, that immediate area, there are some closures that maybe people can't get in and out of. In the city of Asheville, the downtown area, that's up higher. The elevation there is higher from where the flooding is taking place. That right now, there are no problems. But as you spread out through some of the other areas, through the national forests that are in the areas of western North Carolina, there are closures. There's one trail that is closed for the first time ever since it's been open because of all the rain that has happened.
And you say there's more rain coming.
We have more rain forecast through the rest of the week. Most of the flood warnings are in effect until Friday. So we'll see. Everyone's just kind of hoping to hang on here and hoping that we don't get anything more catastrophic and that the ground and the rivers and the banks and all that can really handle what's going to come right now because they're beginning to be unable to handle it.
That's Matt Bush, news director at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina. Matt, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
According to a study published just this week from Johns Hopkins University researchers, a problem pregnancy combined with genes associated with a higher risk of schizophrenia can significantly increase the risk of the child developing schizophrenia. Sharon Begley is senior science writer with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Sharon, how was this study conducted?
So, Robin, what they did is take thousands of people, about half of them with schizophrenia and half without. They did a genetic analysis to look for, in particular, 108 genes that a few years ago were identified as all raising the risk of schizophrenia, but each by a teeny tiny bit. And then they took a step beyond that, namely looking at the condition of the pregnancy that led to the individuals. They looked for a whole bunch of complications, but in particular, preeclampsia, which is basically gestational high blood pressure, but also diabetes, obesity, and a number of things that can in total affect the fetus and in particular how healthy the placenta was. So the whole idea was to look at both the genetics, nature as it were, and the environment, i.e. nurture, simplistically defined, to see how they might work together to affect an individual's risk of developing schizophrenia.
So this is fascinating because we know that schizophrenia is very complicated and that 108 regions of the genome have been identified as raising the risk of getting the disease. And then you're saying that they also found that when there are problems during the pregnancy that affected the placenta, you named some, but others might be alcohol, smoking.
Yes, exactly. And as you're saying, the placenta is key here.
Well, so many people are surprised to hear that there's something other than genetics that could produce something like schizophrenia. We already know that there are environmental impacts as well. But tell us more about how important this research is.
Right. So why this is so interesting is why, you know, people wave their hands and say, oh, yes, everything we are, everything we become is the product of both nature and nurture. But generally, those two things are thought of as existing separately and separately individually contributing to whether someone develops, you know, whatever, breast cancer, a mental illness, just, you know, the list goes on and on and on. Where this study stands out is by finding that whether the genes, the 108 genes, are turned on, whether they are active, whether they do as, the, you know, they are billed to do, depends on the environment. Literally, the environment in which those genes find themselves, specifically in utero, in the placenta, will either turn them on, in which case there is a greater risk of schizophrenia, or keep them off, in which case there is hardly at all an elevated risk of schizophrenia. So where this study really makes its mark is by showing, and this is something that a researcher not involved in it told me, showing that genes do not exist in a lockbox. Whether they are expressed or not depends on the environment in which they, in which the individual, finds him or herself. And that's what is so important, because I think in this age of genetics, it's very easy to become a genetic determinist, i.e. you think that my genes are what will make me and I have no choice in the matter. But in fact, environment turns genes on or keeps them off.
Well, you make other comparisons. You say that, for instance, we know that the BRCA mutation can raise the risk of breast cancer. So can not bearing children. It can raise your risk of breast cancer. But those two don't have the same molecular mechanism. In this case, the placenta and the genetics, it's all in one place. Because I thought we already knew that you could have the genetic predisposition for schizophrenia and a trauma, let's say a huge psychological trauma, might unleash those genes. But they're not in the same, as you say, molecular pathway.
The connection between trauma and schizophrenia is more like the BRCA breast cancer example, that trauma is thought to sort of tip the brain into a state where it's more likely to develop schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. But it's not believed, or at least it hasn't been found, that trauma literally turns the risk genes on mm-hmm. or off, exactly. But in this case, the conditions in utero do seem to do that. And the take-home message is one that nobody would disagree with, that, you know, prenatal care, prenatal health, taking care of the mother and the fetus before birth is crucial. But again, the sort of larger message is don't think that just because you carry risk genes that you are fated to develop some disease.
Well, let's underscore what you just said. So there are things that women can do, knowing this, to take really good care, and also health care providers. I mean, prenatal care seems like it's, you know, this makes it profoundly important, even though we knew it was. But can this be applied to other illnesses like, you know, the researcher you mentioned who said genes are in a lockbox is studying autism?
Yes, she is. And there, too, she is looking at whether the genes are expressed in both in the placenta and in the fetus. Her work has not yet shown what conditions of pregnancy do that. So whether it is also preeclampsia, diabetes, obesity, etc., remains to be discovered. But there is no question that, you know, the conditions before birth are crucial to determining whether or not the genes that the fetus carries are going to be turned on. And again, you know, every obstetrician knows you have to watch for high blood pressure in an expectant mother. But this just emphasizes that prenatal care is so important for both, you know, mothers-to-be and their care providers to really, really pay attention to.
Sharon Bigley, senior science writer at STAT, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll link you to the research at hereandnow.org. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.